Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam, over the past maybe 5 or 6 episodes, you have heard me talk ad nauseum about the Values Bridge exercise. Sarah and I talked about it in our episode where we decided that our business was going to shift. And now I'm here solo again, as I was in the beginning. And a lot of that came down to the work that we did because of the Values Bridge exercise. And today we get to talk to Susie Welch, who created the Values Bridge, and who is also an award-winning NYU Stern School of Business professor, acclaimed researcher, and 3-time New York Times bestselling author, most recently with, and please just go buy this book immediately, Becoming You, A Proven Method for Crafting Your Authentic Life and Career, which is also a #1 bestseller on Amazon, a graduate of Harvard University and Harvard Business School, NBD. Dr. Welch is a frequent guest of The Today Show and an op-ed contributor to The Wall Street Journal. She serves on the boards of public and private companies and is the director of the NYU Stern Initiative on Purpose and Flourishing, which is last year where we met for the first time.
Yeah.
And where I stumbled into that totally almost by accident. A previous patient from my Prague days when I was living in Europe wrote to me and said, Kate, my daughter and I are going to go to this thing. Why don't you meet up with us? I think you'd like it. And I sat there the whole day, like, enraptured. So, Susie, thank you for all the things.
Thank you. I'm so glad you were there and that our paths crossed. And I can't wait for you to come to the next conference for the Initiative on Purpose and Flourishing. I'm excited too.
I'm so excited. And I've since then, I've had Jerry Colon on the podcast. I talked to Zach Mercurio a couple of weeks ago. I'm talking to Vijay Pendekar pretty soon. Yes. So
just all fantastic.
All the good things. So I want to jump right in because I'm going to start with a little tiny personal story, which is not typical, but
I love a personal story,
but the Values Bridge really changed how I've been treating myself since I took it.
Okay.
Because I have a very low non-SIBI score. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that because my whole life I've thought I want to help people. Mm. And then I went into a helping profession. Mm-hmm. I worked as a waitress and bartender during college. I went into a helping profession. Mm-hmm. I kept ending up burnt out. Mm-hmm. I kept not understanding what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I have a radius score that's off the charts.
Yep.
And a non-SIBI score that's really minimal. Yeah. And so, folks, for those of you that don't know the terminology just yet, the radius means I want to have a big impact and I want to use my voice.
Change the world.
Change the world. I loved in the book, you described it as like, how big of a crater do you want to leave behind when you leave this earth? Like, yeah. I want half the world to be gone. in a good way.
Yeah.
So that was important. But the non-SIBI is how much you want to help people on a one-on-one basis.
That's right.
This internal judgment that I've had around the work that I was doing not being fulfilling for me has been holding me back for years because I was very good at acupuncture. I was very successful at it. I built 2 incredibly successful practices in 2 different countries. I had patients made bracelets that said, "What would Kate say?" on them. I mean, I was good at this.
Yeah.
But it wasn't working for me.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. I mean, I can diagnose this in a hot second, but keep going.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Jump in.
I mean, look, These people think that radius, again, this is the value that reflects how much we want to change the world, how big a crater we want to leave, how much systemic change we want, does not always, and in fact, pretty often, does not track with the value of non-sibi, which is Latin for not for oneself, which is the, it's a very intimate thing. It's like you're in the supermarket and somebody can't reach something on the top shelf. High non-sibi is like, you're going to get that on the top shelf. Non-sibi is like, you want to stop for the person with the flat tire. It's, you know, nurses, as we have this research, nurses tend to have very high non-sibi. They want to be in the trenches, you know, helping people on an individual basis, but it just, it doesn't always go together. You know, you want to, if you want to change the world, it doesn't necessarily mean you want to get something for somebody off the top shelf or help somebody on an intimate basis. And in fact, you have bigger battles you want to fight. And it's actually kind of, it can feel very tedious to you to help somebody one-on-one because it's slowing you down from helping 1,000. And so a lot of times people who have high radius go into jobs that just are non-sibi and they get burnt out. And by contrast, people who have high non-sibi sometimes are drawn to organizations that are radius type organizations. You know, they want to go work for some company, some nonprofit like Save the Children or something, an organization that fights poverty. And they get overwhelmed by the things that come radius, with radius changing the world, the fact that you feel like you never, ever, ever are going to do it. And so these are very separate values and they present separate ways and people make so many mistakes that just can really screw up their lives if they don't understand that difference. So,
yeah. And I think what I took from it and what I see so frequently, so even though I've learned now that one-on-one work is not my best place, I've done over 30,000 acupuncture treatments. I've had over 1,000 coaching clients. I mean, I've done plenty of it. And one of the things that I see all the time is this. I was interested because when I was reading my own gap around this and sort of what to do about it, it wasn't like, oh, you know, there's a friction between your two values. It was a, you're just worried what people are going to think about that. So get over it, kind of.
Well, there can be a friction.
There can be.
They're not necessarily in conflict, but sometimes people like you are really mystified why, if they want to change the world, their job helping people is not fulfilling to them. And it's exactly this sort of, you know, look, your scarcest resource is your energy. And if what your real strong value is to change the world and you are doing one-on-one work, it can feel really like you wonder, like, why isn't this feeling good to me? This is the case with all of the values. It's, you know, what ones do you actually have and how much are you living them? You know, that's the thing about the bridge is it tests both of those. So you have high radius. You probably were not fulfilling it nearly as much as you wanted to. You had low non-sibi and you were certainly overexpressing it.
100%. And so the thing that I see most often in other people is this same exact problem. Mm-hmm. This idea that the values that they truly have are not the ones that they deem societally acceptable or morally correct or right. And I see that happen all the time.
Yes. This is why the values bridge, I had a lot of exercises when I started to teach the Becoming You methodology, which is this purpose finding methodology that gave rise to the values bridge. When I first started teaching that methodology at NYU, I had a bunch of reflective exercises that were designed to help students ferret out their values. And I discovered incredibly quickly, like in one semester, that nobody wanted to confess their true values to the world. Like these were very well-designed exercises. I still use some of them. They sort of loosen up your muscles to help you identify your values. But people would come up with their list of values based on these exercises. And then literally they'd manually manipulate them. Like they'd erase something that was down at number 7 and they'd move it up to number 1. And they'd erase something at number 2 and move it down to number 8. Yeah. Because they said, wait. For instance, take the value of family centrism, which is having family as your organizing principle. And for some people, we do all the exercises and oops, family would show up at number 15. And then they would think, oh my God, what if my mother ever saw this? And they like literally would like cross it out and move it up to number 1, even though it wasn't their authentic value. So the values bridge, which is a digital tool, which is incredibly carefully constructed by psychometricians and so forth, was constructed so that you could finally stare face-to-face with the true rank ordering of your values. And nobody's going to see it but you. You know, nobody's going to see the data about what those true values are and also the data about, unless you'd like to share it, the data of like how much you're actually living it. What's the gap? Because I see all the time people come in and their number one value is, say, voice, which is authentic self-expression, not for everybody, but for many people. And they'll have a 99% authenticity gap, meaning they're not living it at all. And they stare at it and they say, I think you've just summed up my life. And I say, that's what the tool's supposed to do. And then it's, you know, then the next step is figuring out what to do about that.
Yeah. And so I love this, especially for the burnt out crowd in general, because one of the things, another thing that you said in the book was that a lot of times, this was when you were talking about interests, but it still connects together. You were saying sometimes when people don't know that they have, like, I'm not interested in anything anymore. I just have nothing. I've not interested. Right. Screw the world. Like, I can't
interest
handle this.
Interest ennui, where people are like, nothing's calling me. Yeah.
Yeah. And that sometimes that's a result of burnout. And
that's anxiety. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that sometimes there's this crossover between that and the not knowing your values. And I do think that that's the beauty of the exercise that you created. It's just right there.
Right. It just is. This is the journey of our life, is to find out this data about ourselves, and almost everything stands in the way of it. I call them the four horsemen of values destruction. The first one is economic security. And everybody wants to, believe me, nobody doesn't want economic security. But the problem is that voice can get very loud in our head and we stop listening to what we really want because we think basically, I need money. And I get it. But some, you know, when we, now that we have data from 120,000 people have taken the values bridge in the past 6 months. And actually, as it falls out, affluence or the drive for money as the top motivation is number 11 out of 16 overall. It's different for different generations. And for, you know, we could cut this data every which way. But in general, we assume that money should be our top value, or that it is a top value. But at the end of the day, it's actually not as high as most people would think. And so economic security is a number one, is a very loud voice in our head that gets in the way of us hearing what our real values are. And then there's expectations, you know, what my family would expect, what society would expect. I had a student who said to me, like, oh, look, everything that we're doing says I should be a Roomba teacher. How does this methodology know that I love Roomba so much? And, you know, my thought was, well, you keep on telling it in one way or the other. And then at the end, she said, I can't do this because I'm an MBA. And, you know, this was sort of the culmination of the expectations of her family and her upbringing and society. Like, MBAs don't become Roomba teachers. And then there's...
Are we talking about the vacuum or the exercise?
The exercise.
Zumba.
Oh, I keep on calling you. It shows you that I use neither. Zumba.
I love it.
I'm so glad you caught me on that one, because I like literally have told that story before, and I'm sure everybody in the audience is thinking she's talking about Zumba. All right. Then there's expedience. Yes. Where we don't follow our values because it's so hard. Yeah. And life is hard enough already. So then if we have to also follow our values, and usually, you know what the hard part is telling somebody else what they are. Like, somebody's going to be mad, or we're going to have to move, or we'll have to go back to school. And it's just too hard.
Yeah.
And then, you know, events get in the way. You know, we're going to live our values. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. And then, we get laid off, or somebody gets sick, or a kid goes off the rails. And all the big dreams you had to live your values get swept away in events.
Yeah.
And all four of those things conspire against us living our values. And then you add the other layer of the fact that we have no tool to actually identify and rank order our values. And you end up having a lot of people who just let life happen to them. Yeah. And when I teach Becoming You in the intensive sessions that we have for the in open enrollment at NYU, people come from around the world to do it. It's a beautiful thing. They come for 3 days. I teach the whole methodology in the course of 3 days. The number one thing people say to explain what they're doing there is, my life just happened to me, and I want to figure out if I should change direction. And I mean, I guilty as charged. I mean, for many, many years, that was me. You do your best. You live by default. It comes at you and you kind of do your best with it, but you're not living by design, which is the alternative. And, you know, if burnout is what you do not want, the best defense is always a good offense. And the good offense is living a life of design, a life that's built around your values and your aptitudes and your interests.
Do you do this at a scale, like within a company, as much as, because I know that there's the Becoming You weekends and I know that there's the individual work, but are you doing this work also like at an organization?
The problem with doing it in an organization is most organizations do not want me coming in because when I leave, everybody wants to quit. And so I do it here and there for very enlightened organizations. And typically the CEO has come to one of the Becoming You weekends and then says, come do this for the people in my company, because I only want the people there who want to be there. So we'll go do it for 100 or 200 people. And then I, you know, I go and I do it for people who invite me, like retreats or, you know, at conferences and so forth. And so, but we are, and then, you know, we have a coaching certification program. So when a lot of the work is being done by the coaches who are now certified and they by NYU and they go out and do it in the wild, as we say.
Yeah. So this is the, this is where I feel like, gosh, I wish there was more enlightened leaders pulling you into, or the coaches or whoever it is pulling you in to do this work, because when there's alignment there, when there's match between the person that you've hired and the job that they're supposed to do and the values of the company that they work for, when there's alignment there, your profitability goes up.
Right. And, you know, I think it is, but it does take an enlightened leader. It does take an enlightened leader who says, I don't want people here. I want people here by design. I want them here by choice. And I want to be able to talk to my people about values. Our organization's values and yours are aligned. Isn't that marvelous? And I think that it's just a matter of time before it is more in organizations, because everybody who's coming to the, or, you know, comes to the 3-day immersives, 90% of them, 99% of them work in organizations and they bring it back to their companies. Right. I mean, a lot, you know, every single time we have one of these, people come and say, you know, my coworker came or my boss came and I wanted to, so I, it's a matter of time. Right now, you know, we're early days. We've only really been out there, been doing this. I've only been doing it 5 years. And so I think it will end up in organizations because it needs to.
Well, yeah, it has to. And there's 42 years of research that say that values misalignments are one of the top six factors of burnout in the workplace, right? Like, we know that it's not, this is not new information. Right. I didn't even create it, right?
Like, not only is that research, which I was part of a team that replicated it, because good research gets replicated. Yeah. Not only is that research old and established, the factor analysis is so high. It's like, it's not like, a little bit you should be aligned with values with the organization. No, it's like so much you should be aligned. It is the number one driver of work satisfaction.
And so, folks listening, my fried people out there, or my leaders who are trying to not fry people, being able to jump into work like this and do it with intention and do it with transparency. And it's honestly a little scary. Mm. It's scary to say out loud that non-sibi is not high for me. That's scary to me.
I want to say this. Can I interrupt you to say this?
Yeah.
The values bridge and all of the work of Becoming You is values agnostic. It believes.
Yeah, exactly.
It believes there are no good or bad values. If you're not hurting anybody, your values are your values to live and fully express. And that's an important clause, if you're not hurting anybody. But like somebody like you who has high radius, you want to change the world, and lower non-sibi, meaning you want to do it through systemic change and not necessarily through one-on-one, you know, hand-to-hand combat. You're not hurting anybody. You're helping people. You're not in any way hurting anyone. Those are your values. Lean into them, celebrate them, and by all means, talk about them openly. Because I think the beautiful thing to me, well, there's so many beautiful things about the values bridge because it's like my baby that I love so much. But I would say that it gives us a language to talk about values that is non-acrimonious, that is non-judgmental. I mean, I have different values from my own. I have four adult children and they're wonderful spouses. And you got to believe we don't have the same values. They were raised at a different time. They're totally different people than me. I love them more than a mother can love any. I mean, I adore my children. They're my best friends. I love them in every way. Their values are different than mine. I have a much higher value of, say, achievement, which is seen success other people can see, and work centrism, which is work for the sake of work. You just love work. Okay. They are generationally very aligned in that they do not have work centrism and achievement as high as I do. They have it higher than many of their peers, but not as high as I have it, which is I have it off the chart. And instead of us having conversations where you say things like, mom's a workaholic, and mom says, you're just lazy and you don't know the value of work, we could literally have conversations that sound like this, like, well, my work centrism is kicking in today and I'm going to be working, you know, on Saturday. And you enjoy, I said this over Christmas, you enjoy your sledding. I'm enjoying my work centrism over here. And we just like have these wonderful conversations about what's going on with our motivations without pointing fingers, without kind of hating on each other. Everybody has to live their values truly for their own sense of authenticity and fulfillment. Well, let's stop judging each other, you know? Now, look, it's important to point out that values are not virtues. With virtues, I can be quite judgy, okay? Virtues are things like fairness, decency, kindness. Virtues are social and cultural constructs that we all agree are good. And if you don't like kindness, I don't want to know you. And if you don't have kindness, I'm perfectly comfortable saying that's bad. Okay. But when it comes to values, which are how we want to show up in the world in terms of like choice, they're choices around how much we work, how much we organize our lives around helping people or around, you know, we don't just have to stop judging people. People are not built the same. Each one of us is different. But virtues, you know, I don't want like integrity is a virtue. Honesty is a virtue. I don't think these are choices. And so I want to be very, very clear. I'm not like live and let live about everything. No, I think everyone should be honest and everyone should be kind and everyone should have integrity and so forth. So, but how much you work, as long as you're willing to accept the consequences of it, it's fine. Your choice.
Yeah.
You know, how much you care about radius, as long as you're able to accept the consequences of it, your choice.
Yeah. And so this is one of the things that I actually love about the work the most is that that is constantly repeated in the work over and over and over again, that there is no morality attached to this. There's no better or worse. There just is or there isn't. And there just is
with
for
values.
You, or, right?
With
values,
values yeah.
with the
yeah,
values
right.
specifically. And so I really like that part. That doesn't change the fact that facing it can be well, maybe I'll speak in I sentences.
Okay.
It was difficult for me for a moment, and then it gave me freedom.
Yes, that is the common experience. I'll never forget when a friend of mine got her results back, and her number one value was luminance, which is fame. Okay, how famous you want to be. It's her number one value. I mean, and at the other end of the continuum is if you have very low luminance, you kind of want to live off the grid all the way to you want to be so famous you can't go outside, everyone would recognize you. And she had as her number one value luminance. She had an authenticity gap of 94% because she's not famous at all. And she threw down her results and she said, this test is terrible. It's completely inaccurate. And I knew her really. I know her very, very well. And I said, why don't you just ponder that for a little while? Let's talk in 20 minutes, okay? Because we have 94% efficacy. We know this test works because we've tested it so many times. But beyond that, I knew her very well and I knew exactly what her true values were because I've watched her for many years. 20 minutes, 25 minutes later, she comes back and I said, want to talk? And she said, you're right. This is my number one value. And I have so much pain around the fact that I never had the courage to chase it the way I wanted to. And it was a painful moment. I mean, speaking in I terms, if she was talking, she would say, I had agony facing into the true number one value for me that I never was able even to admit to myself. It was very liberating for her once she knew it to be
yes.
able to talk about every decision she'd made along the way that she had regret around, that she had blamed other people for, her sadness about certain things she had done. And I mean, I think that it's changed her life to finally know the truth about herself. It is liberating once you come to terms with the rank ordering of them. Yeah.
Yes. And so the rank ordering of them, and then I want to jump into some other parts of the Becoming You methodology. So the rank ordering of them, you made a post a couple of weeks ago on LinkedIn. We're recording this at the end of January. I think it might have been in November or December. And it got a lot of people were up and down about it.
Okay.
It was really interesting. It was the one where you said, right now, according to the people that are taking the Values Bridge assessment now, only 11% of people have family centrism as a top value.
That's right.
And the internet exploded.
Yes. And a lot of that was because I wrote a piece about it for the Wall Street Journal where I often publish my data, and it was explosive. I knew it would be because they accepted the piece so quickly. I always know how explosive a piece is when I send it to them and 5 minutes later they say, we'll take it. And I think, oh, they know I'm going to be killed. They love that. So look, this is what the data shows. You know, we have now 120,000 people have taken the Values Bridge. So we have the values. I mean, this is the cleanest richest data set of its kind in the world. We don't know another one like it. When Gallup does the testing on values, they have 2,000 people. We have 120,000 data points. And so I thought, well, Thanksgiving's coming. I thought, let's see how people actually feel about family, because everybody's going to kill themselves to get back to their family. And then everybody's going to feel like, Thanksgiving's complicated. All holidays are complicated. Yeah. Yeah. So let's see how Americans actually feel about family centrism. So we looked at all of the data. And look, it's different for different incomes, for genders, for age groups. But if you look at it in aggregate for the entire U.S. population, that family centrism comes 11th out of 16. But the most sort of more shocking data was that people say family is their number one value. Mm-hmm. They do, but it's only 9% of Americans, 9% that actually have family centrism as their number one value. And it's only 40% that have it in their top five values. Okay. Yeah. So for all the lip service that we give to family, and for all the rigmarole we go to get back to our families on the holidays, and for all when you separate identity and you separate everything out, only 9% truly are operating with family as their central organizing principle, and under half are having it in their top five values. And people, there were people who said, thank God somebody is saying this. It allows me to sort of feel not alone. And no wonder the holidays are hard for me. And I love my family, but it has its, I'm not living for them, but I love them. And that's whatever. If you're not hurting anybody, that's fine. I think that, it felt like a stick in the eye to other people who were very invested in this value. And I get it. And I mean, I think that there was a lot of, I happen to be a very faithful person myself, but there was a response from the faith community that was like, family is the foundation of society. And this data is dangerous because it says nobody has family as their number one value. And I have a long response to that, which I will not get into here. But this data about what true values are is always explosive, I have found.
Yeah. And so I wanted to bring that one out, because I think that people get stuck on that one often and don't give themselves permission to live the lives they want because of a value that is not truly theirs, because they think it should be, because culture says, because religion says, et cetera says. And when you made the post, when you posted the article and made the video on LinkedIn, the thing that hit me was that you said, this has absolutely nothing to do with how much you love your family.
That's right. It's about how you want to organize the minutes of your day. And I mean, I love my children more than I love them desperately, but I was a working mother because I didn't want to organize. I love them, but I'm not going to organize my entire life around them. That's it. But there are power to the people who decide to do that. Sure. They've got a different rank order of values, and everything worked out great. I'm happy to say, thank goodness for it. And so look, your values are your values. And when you're not living them, you tend to be in a lot of pain, emotional and psychic pain. The other value besides family centrism that people have a real war with self about is achievement. Okay. Because there's a lot of received information that we get about, it's important to be ambitious. It's important to want to be successful. And if you look at Gen Z, achievement is not a value. And not only is it's a very, very low value, but not only is it a very low value, they have a negative variance on it. And I'll just sort of cut through the data to say that basically what that says is that it's a low value and they wish it was even lower. Yeah. Okay. And you go to the older generations and achievement is not as high as you would think, which would suggest that people have been lying about achievement for a long time, but it's definitely higher. And the friction you feel between parents and kids and employers and employees is that there's different feelings around this value of achievement. And it used to be thought that's the American way, but now to look at the data, it's not. And I'm actually just about to start a gigantic research study with my alma mater for my PhD, the University of Bristol in England, to be taking a look at the values bridge in five different countries so that we can get the data on all of these different values in China, India, the UK, France, and Indonesia. And it will be very interesting to see where achievement comes in. I think there's geopolitical consequences, actually, if we see achievement is number one in India and China, and it's number, 13 in the United States, that we have to plan around that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my top five. Achievement is one of my top five, and I'm overdoing it a little bit.
All right. Did you have a negative variance?
Uh-huh.
Oh. Okay. Maybe you are overdoing it a little, but you can't take your value out of you. You have it. It's
And I actually really enjoy achievement, and I always have. Yeah. And so I was really okay with that one. I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
I also have high achievement. I think, you know, maybe all podcasters have high achievement.
It is possible. It is possible. So I want to just, before we move to the next part, just do this reminder that there's no morality attached to these.
No judgment. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, these are not virtues. We're not talking about the great virtues of honesty, kindness, fairness. These are something that everybody should have more of. Values are decisions about how we negotiate the world, how we organize our time. And you should not be hurting anybody with your values. I want to be clear about that. I mean, if your family centrism and where it is hurting your children, that's a totally different conversation. In as much as you are not hurting people with your values are your values to live.
I love that. And then I was so obsessed with the values bridge when I bought the book. So I had already done the values bridge and I was reading through the book and I was getting in depth onto the different. And I know there's one extra popped up in the meantime, but there was 15 when you wrote the book. There's 16 values now. And then when I read through the book and you were like, well, and then you have to figure out your aptitudes and then you have to figure out your, you know, economically viable interests.
Right.
And I looked at that and I was like, okay, she created this like slam dunk assessment. And even she knows it's not a full picture.
Yes. In fact, I think it's dangerous just to try to figure out your life just based on your values, because there's other information you've got to get, like what you're good at. Those are aptitudes, like what you're good at emotionally and cognitively, like your personality and your brain wiring. That's aptitudes. So we have 4 tests for that.
Yeah.
And then your interests, your economically viable interests, which is the stuff that you want to do that can pay you what you want and need to be paid. And so there's 3 legs to our stool, and that's why it's a methodology and not a silver bullet. And, you know, it's very interesting. Any of the data that you get from the methodology is so interesting and informative and can be life expanding. But I always say they're all tiles in the mosaic of the portrait that we're painting, this portrait of you standing still so that you know which way to go when you start running again. And all the tiles matter. So both all your values, great. You got to get those. Now it's easy because the values bridge exists in 22 minutes. You can get them 22 to 25 minutes. And then you've got to do the work to figure out your aptitudes. And the world wants to tell you what your aptitudes are also. They want to tell you what you're good at, but we can test for that. And so we do.
And I want to talk about you in the book, when you talked about the aptitudes, you were like, people always fill this in wrong to start. When people are doing it without an assessment, they're like, well, I'm good at, you know, riding a bicycle. And you're like, that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Can you explain to people what you mean by aptitude in the Becoming You methodology? Because I think it's a really special specification.
Well, it's a social science specification of it. I mean, I think people like to mix up, and it's very natural and very normal to mix up aptitudes with skills, which you can learn, or areas of expertise, which you can learn. But aptitudes are underlying propensities. So like, if you can think about it this way, if you were to pick up a pen and write your name with your dominant hand, it would be easy and you could do it all day long. But if you have to switch the pen into your other hand, it's awkward and ugly. And say you broke your dominant hand and you had to spend the rest of your life writing with your non-dominant hand, eventually you get better at it. My premise is that it's better to spend your life doing the stuff that you're naturally good at. Now, you may disagree. And in fact, you may have values that would drive you to do the stuff that you're not naturally good at, but go into it with your eyes open. For me, the sort of ideal place to be is at the overlap, the intersection of your values, your aptitudes, the stuff you're naturally good at, and your economically viable interests. So we do a lot of work to figure out what you're naturally good at. And we do that with a bunch of different tests. We have a test called the Career Traits Compass, which tells you on the continuum from individual contributor to leader, where do you fall? And we have a test that allows the world to tell you how you're being experienced in terms of how you act with people and how many ideas you have and how well you get stuff done, because execution is a very important skill to have. And so a very important aptitude to have. And so it's important to know, because like, if you just love doing it and it matches your values and you're terrible at it, I'm going to suggest the word hobby enter your mind. And that what you should seek, in my opinion, and the Becoming You methodology's premise, is the stuff that you want to do because it's a value, what you can do really well because it's an aptitude, and what you should do because it's interesting to you and it's in an economic sphere that's growing.
when I was reading through that aptitude section, I was reading through one part of it and I thought, oh, okay, I get it. Like for example, folks that are listening, one of the things that happens really naturally in my brain is I form really quick patterns and synthesis of information. I can read 5 research studies in like 12 minutes because my brain just goes bing, 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 and pulls them all together into something that I can give to you clearly, which is why the Straight from Kate episodes on the podcast get so much attention compared to some of the other episodes, because you know that I can do that for you. So that's an aptitude.
It's inductive reasoning. It's a very specific aptitude.
Yeah.
And the people who are at the other end of that continuum tend to be sort of much more in the details and the process and the fact checking. And they're very gifted at other things.
Yes.
But they're not gifted at that. Right.
I love them because I need them because I can't survive without them because I cannot do what they do. Right now, I'm the president of the National Speakers Association in New York City, and we keep having our admin keeps sending us emails to check before they get sent out. And I keep writing back and being like, yeah, it looks good. And then somebody writes back like, there's a typo. And I'm like, oops.
Right. I mean, whenever I'm on a board and they say, did everybody read the minutes of the last meeting? I'm like, gee, I hope somebody does that. I mean, that's just not my, it's not about time. It's just about aptitude. Yeah. I usually what happens is the people who are the lawyers in the room go, yes, I noticed on page 17 that there's missing a clause about blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh my God. But they're in the details and the world needs them.
Yes.
And people who are inductive reasoners like you and I are desperately need them on our team and by our side. And so it's super important to understand, are you a generalist or a specialist? Yeah. Are you a future focuser or a present focuser? Are you inductive reasoner or a fact checker? To understand how your brain is wired to do its best work, this is some of the most powerful data you'll ever have about yourself, and you've got to own it. You've got to know it. Guessing is not good enough.
Yeah. And it's, again, there's not a better or worse.
Absolutely.
Again, we're back in this idea that it's neutral. It's just information about how your brain functions.
But it's better or worse for different types of jobs and different types of pursuits. I mean, like, you know, woe be to the future focuser, inductive reasoner who becomes a contract lawyer. I mean, it's like, it's
shoot just, me now.
Right. I mean, then they're being asked to do something that is not natural to their brain every single day. Yeah. And I have so many stories from students who are smart, smart, smart. Oh, they could do anything. And then they go to a job and it's a specialist job and they're generalists and they're crawling out of their skin every day. And they're like, why can't I be good at this? I was good at everything in school. And the answer is because you're not playing to your, and frankly, if they stayed at it for a couple of years, if they don't get fired, eventually they could get better at it. But why not go do what you're naturally good at? Why not?
Yeah. No. Yes. This was one of the other things in the acupuncture world. God, keeping soap notes for patients.
No, can do.
Oh, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't
do it. Because I'm sure you're a generalist. And keeping notes on things. Are you kidding me? No, can do.
Mm-mm, yeah. Can't do it. And then the last part, which is, this is something that came up a lot in our family a few years ago, this sort of interests that are economically viable, the EVI, right?
You
call them in the book. And
yes,
my niece was going to college and she decided she was going to study psychology. And my father-in-law has a lot of weird ideas about the world, but he decided that psychology, when she went to school, this was 7 years ago or so, that we're not going to need psychologists by the time you graduate. That's not viable. Okay, sir,
right.
But whatever.
Okay, right.
And at the time I sat down with her and I was doing an online course about how to run a business online. So I was just sort of opening this world for myself. This is 2016, mm-hmm. maybe 2015. Mm-hmm. And I realized while I was doing that, there was a shit ton more jobs that I never knew existed.
Yes.
That people were living perfectly good lives doing. And I thought to myself, how small is my vision of what is economically viable? Mm-hmm. Am I just doing the whole like doctor, lawyer, engineer mm-hmm. thing?
Absolutely. You were. Right. Because you, like everyone else, gets on the conveyor belt. And there's research that shows that when kids graduate from high school, they can only list 5 jobs, 2 of which are their parents. And then they graduate from college. You think, oh, now their aperture is opened and they'll know about all the different jobs in the world. It's not taught in any college class. You know, you go to college, you could learn about the history of Argentina, but you're not going to learn what kind of businesses and jobs are out there. It gets even worse in graduate school. The conveyor belts get very noisy. You get right onto one of them. Yeah. I play industry bingo with my students so that they can learn about the 135 industries. And then I teach megatrends so they can understand about the 12 identified megatrends, although I think it's going to be 13 next semester. And, you know, there's just, you have to prying open your aperture for what kind of work exists, what kind of roles exist, it's not a natural act. People are trying to close down that aperture so they can start figuring out what they should do before they even open it all the way. There are types of work and jobs. Now, of course, AI is throwing everything into disruption and disarray. Sure. And so better all the more to know what your values and aptitudes are so that you can figure out where you fit into this new world. But like people just don't look around because it's hard to. It's noisy. How do you make sense of it?
Yeah. And I was just at, as a speaker, I work with a lot of associations, and I was just at the Association of Airport Consultants, or the Airport Consultant Council, maybe it was called. Right. I think it was an ACC, which I always confuse with the lawyer one that I also work with. The Association of Corporate, the Association of Corporate Counsel is also an ACC one. Anyway, not important. I was in that room and they said, our biggest industry issue right now is that kids don't know that we exist and nobody's choosing this as a career path. There is so much money here. There's so much money to be made. It's insane. All of us have way too many projects that we cannot finish. We are dying for bodies and nobody knows we exist.
100%. This is totally confirmed by everything I've encountered. And this, I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal about this called Hello MBA, It's Me, Industry. Because my MBAs are like, there are three industries. Those industries are finance, consulting, and tech.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute. There's also like tree and nut farming. You know, there's like, there is aviation, there's shipbuilding, there's mining, there's airport consultants, you know, there's graphic facilitators. That's an exploding field. And they're like blinders on, which is very natural. One of the reasons it's natural is because the consulting and banking people are sitting on campus saying, hey, come on over here. The weather's wonderful. And they make it very, very easy. And you have to show a lot of initiative and you have to do a little bit of digging and you have to look around. And it's hard. And you've got, in my case, many of my students have debt and they're like, get me a job right away. Whereas it's harder to get those jobs out there. But this is a true dynamic that you, and that's why part of the Becoming You methodology is to force open your aperture and say, okay, where are the jobs you're not looking at? What are you not seeing?
And where can you apply these values and aptitudes in ways that you might not have even considered or thought of before? It's out there. It's ready. It's here. It's available. Right. There's a job that's waiting for you that really aligns with everything that you need that you don't even know exists.
I know. I mean, we actually created a tool that takes all of the data that you gather in Becoming You, your values, your aptitudes, and your interests, and we put it, it's called Career Catalyst. You dump all that data in and it tells you three jobs that are at the intersection of all of that data. And people are like, I never would have thought of this. And it's like, that's right. Yeah. You wouldn't have, because it's a really hard, unnatural act to think of it, but it's there for you. And then it's very exciting to see what happens.
Yeah. And I think that's also true. Like if your values, if you have a scope as a high value, you might be a little more in tune to other things that are available because you're in tune to other things that are out there. Right.
Like, right. But the number of people with high scope is quite limited.
It's my number one.
Is it really?
Yes.
Oh, I don't meet somebody like you very often. It's only 11% have it at number one.
Yeah.
But I have one of my favorite students had it at number one in her state. Scope, by the way, is the value for your listeners. Scope is the value of wanting to have a very big world with a lot of stimulation, with a lot of learning, with a lot of adventure. It's like you, and at the other end of that continuum, no better or worse, lower scope is people who would like a lot of psychological safety, a lot of visibility, a lot of predictability. They do not want chaos. Whereas high scope people like both of us are like, bring the chaos. I like the excitement. And that's just, those are just choices. If you're not hurting anybody, fabulous. But you're right. High scope people do tend to cast their nets wider. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, folks, that was a lot of information at once, but please know that Susie has organized this information in various places. There is the book. There is the website. Once you do one thing, you'll have links and access to other things. The appendices in her book link to literally every single test and thing that she talked about today. It's all in there.
It's all also on becomingyoulabs.com. That's our website of our actual work, and all of the tests are there as well. And I want us to be clear that with Values Bridge, there's a free version, which gives you your top three or four values. And there's also a paid version, which is $30 for the whole kit and caboodle. So I want to be clear about that.
Okay. It's very, very worth it. Pay the $30, get the full assessment, see where the gaps are. Like it's very, very, very worth it. It's literally my favorite thing, my favorite test that I've done in probably a decade. And I've done them. Oh, well, I really also love predictive index.
Oh, I've got to check that one out.
Yeah, I like predictive index.
Okay.
It helps to figure out how well things are matching in your current job.
Oh, interesting.
It's really interesting.
I've got to check that one out.
Okay. I like the predictive index people, but this is my favorite work. So I am so grateful that we crossed paths. I'm so grateful that you agreed to come speak to my fried listeners. And I'm so excited to see where you take this work further, because I know you're not done. And I know that whatever you create next, I'm going to be excited about. So thank you so much. Do you have any last things that you're like, all right, people, but don't forget this part?
Well, don't forget. All right. Don't forget that it's better to, I've got two things. Can I say?
Of course.
First is that it's better to be the author of your life than the editor. That took me 50 or 60 years to figure out. And, you know, the day I figured it out, I threw my head back and I was like, I'm going to write the rest of the story myself. And no shade on editors. I was an editor myself, but I was tired of having everybody edit Susie. And so I think it's better to be the author. And it couples beautifully with my favorite quote. It's from Emily Dickinson, the poet, but it's actually not in a poem. It was in a letter that she wrote. And it says, "We grow not older with the years, but newer every day." And I feel newer every day. I want to be newer every day. I am getting older. I know it. And I'm not afraid of it. And I'm not embarrassed of it or anything like that. But I like being new. Also, you can get old and new. And I love it. And it's open and it's available to everybody.
In addition to that, folks, the Initiative for Purpose and Flourishing, Flourishing and Purpose, Purpose and Flourishing. Purpose what order flourishing. Does it go? Purpose I said it right the first time. What date is that this year?
It's coming in May. We've got a conference.
In May.
I think it might be.
Okay.
But well, anyway, I think that we've got a conference. You can go to the Initiative at Purpose and Flourishing at NYU. We've got a website.
Yeah.
We do have a couple of Becoming You 3-day intensives coming up. You can check out SusieWelch.com to find those. I think the next one is in May. Still has a few spaces.
And if you are intrigued by any of this, I'm begging you to dive in, because there is... When I finally did the values assessment, I'm just going to tell all of you guys, my gap is only 18. So I'm pretty close to living
there. That's
the life
close,
that yeah. I want. I'm pretty close. And the one thing that's off is scope, the biggest. And I think that's because of COVID.
Yes.
COVID really made things a lot smaller, and I have not rebuilt my life outside of it. But you know, we have a move coming up probably, so it's all going to happen anyway. So
that's right.
It's good.
You'll get your scope back.
I'll get my scope back. But I think that this provides so much clarity and freedom and space to breathe within your own body. If you're a little inclined, please, please, please dive in, not just for you, but because every time somebody does this work, it branches out and helps other people around them.
You're Susie, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your encouragement.
I so appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm so
keep doing
grateful.
What you're doing. Your listeners are so lucky to have you.
I'm lucky to have them. All right, Fried Fam. Until next time. Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.